September 16th, 2015, 7:47 p.m. He was approaching the base of the mountain now, or was he already on it? The land sloping upwards, his breathing coming hard. It wasn't twilight yet, but a star, more likely a planet, had appeared in the enormous sky. He could feel the temperature plummet. He didn't have a coat, and he was wearing the wrong shoes. He inhaled the musk of his own body, his headache intensifying. He was at about 8,000 feet, he'd been told, and labored to breathe the thin, unpolluted air. He closed his eyes, willing away the image, the tufts of hair, the collapsed sockets, the puckered skin. His steps were coming harder now, pain knifing from his throat into his chest, until he stopped and bent over to catch his breath, slow it down. But when he stood straight again, he was hit by a wave of dizziness. He had to reach out into the empty air. He landed on a boulder, where he sat until he was no longer faint. The majestic, misshapen mountain above him was capped by what seemed a fresh coat of snow, even though it was August. It was windy up here, and try as he might, he couldn't slow his breathing. But there was a yawning stillness behind the wind. He heard only his own gasp, a death rattle, the rapid pounding of his heart. Welcome to Word After Word, a podcast on writing. Hello, everyone, and welcome to Word After Word, a podcast on writing. I'm Paul Matthew Carr, and with me, as always, the professor, David Hicks.
Paul, it's been a minute.
It's been several minutes. just to let the listeners know, welcome to the program, first of all. And just to let everyone know, this is the second iteration of this program. We originally did Word After Word, I think it was back in 2017. Does that sound
yes.
right?
Yes, that sounds right.
Yes, we did a handful of episodes, and then the world ended.
Yes. and you would think that's when we would go to the podcast during the pandemic, but no.
No.
Well, we retreated.
Yeah, well, that's the funny thing is, during COVID and during lockdown, we both decided to change our lives completely. You moved to another part of the country, and I just upended everything in my life. But yeah, so just so everyone knows, it's always a great time to completely change your life during a global pandemic. So.
Oh yeah, I was also in another country. So yeah,
yeah, that's what I mean. We changed our lives completely.
Yes, we did.
Yeah. So that being said, we just sort of stopped doing this, but I've always had it in the back of my mind. I wanted to start it up again.
Same here. And we're still the same lovable radio personalities. That
you grew up listening to. I've actually gotten better, if I say so myself.
You have, yeah.
But anyway, so what is this program all about? And well, it's all about writing and the craft of writing and sharing various skills and tricks to become more inspired and proficient at writing. But also I wanted to share the process writers have to achieve this. Because I think learning what other people do kind of helps you out in your own writing life. Do you agree with that?
Oh, absolutely. I just spoke with Amor Towles, the great best-selling writer, and his writing, he's so eloquent about his writing process, and it really made me question my own writing process. And I learned so much, and I thought, well, he does it a little better, so maybe I should do a little bit more. He's a big outliner, he's a big he's a note taker, he's a researcher, but then and he accumulates things for years, little character notes, and then he writes. Whereas I write first and then, very messily kind of revise it down. So yeah, I think we're all of us who write are eager to learn about other writers' processes and to kind of adopt some for ourselves, but also to just, we have this natural curiosity about how people write and when they write and where they write and how do you do this? It's not easy, right? So
yeah,
that's what this podcast is going to do. We either interviewing other writers about their process or their writing strategies, or we talk about different books that are out there, or the ways they came to be published, or how writers promote their own work, all aspects of the writing life, I would say.
Yeah, I agree. And first of all, just for future reference, don't be talking to people without recording it. Everything's content, David.
It's recorded.
It is.
Yes, and I
Oh,
think
this is brilliant.
you could use it as a podcast, I think. But
But yeah.
no one has heard it yet.
Yeah, good. Oh, that's
We could
fantastic.
do it as an exclusive.
Oh, I'm loving it. It's getting better all the time. But yes, to piggyback on what you were saying, if there's one thing I'd like people to get from listening to this podcast is just to feel inspired to create. Because I know from my own personal experience that it can be frustrating and intimidating to create something, and you feel like you're not doing it right, you know. But I just want to emphasize that there is no right way to create. And by sharing the different processes different writers have, I think we'll show that creativity is very personal to each creator, and everyone has their own individual way of creating, and that's what's important. You know, putting your art, how do I say this? Putting your art out there in the world is the important part, because when you put art into the world, you make the world better. And
Oh, that's so true.
so everyone out there, you have a story to tell, you have a song to sing, you have a picture to paint, and that's what's important. So if we can help you achieve that, then we're doing our part.
Love it. Well
Yeah.
said.
So let's get into the meat of this particular episode, and that is you, David.
I've waited so long for this opportunity, so I'm grateful that we decided to talk about me.
Of course. Well, the reason
It's
for
high
that is,
time.
the reason for that is, well, first of all, you're awesome. So we, you know what? Maybe we should introduce ourselves to
Oh,
the Let's go around the table and everybody
Sure.
stand up and tell a little bit about themselves.
Sure.
Yeah.
So you're going first?
I can go first, absolutely. I'm Paul Matthew Carr. As I said, I'm a writer and an artist and a podcaster. You know, I don't have the years of expertise David does in helping people write, but I feel like I feel like I can add a little bit to this conversation as we go along.
Oh God, let's do that again. Let's do that again. With more confidence, please.
No, I'm looking forward to, I love talking about writing, and I love writing, and I love everything about writing, and I love crafting stories and talking about stories with other people. And I look forward to doing that with you, David.
Yeah, thanks. I was trying to think of when we first met. I think it was at least 20 years ago. It might have been 25 years ago.
It might have been 25 years ago, yeah.
Yeah, in Denver. So, and Paul and I are both writers, and we were in a workshop together. And we write in different genres, but we share a love for writing and artistic expression. So, and then in the meantime, Paul has developed a very good radio voice, and I don't. So we need you to carry this podcast, whereas I can chime in once in a while with perhaps an insight or two.
Okay,
But
so should we do that again with a little bit more confidence, David?
Hi, I'm David Hicks. I'm a writer. I've always been a professor of, I have a PhD in literature from NYU, and I started off as an academic, but I always wanted to be a writer. And then in right around 39, 40 years old, I decided to go from a professor who wrote once in a while to a writer who professed once in a while. And I kind of, that was a long shift from one to the other, and it's made my life so much better. I still love being a teacher. I still love helping other writers. I'm a director of the MFA program at Wilkes University now. So I love helping other writers to write and to complete their works and to get published. But at the same time, the real love of my life is my own writing and my own process. It takes me years to finish books. I've got about 20 something short stories published and three books. But it really, I love the process. I love revising. I love even once it's done, I love reading from my books because I'm very proud of them. So being on a podcast where I get to talk about writing and we get to interview other writers about writing, that's my jam. I'm really looking forward to it.
You actually have a really great article from a few years ago called "Writer, Love Your Words," and I'd like to share that on our website if that's good. Because
Cool. Can I,
it's a
did I,
yeah.
did I ever tell you the story about that?
No,
The
please do.
writer, oh, so the background of that is that, and this makes sense to talk about it now, right? We're okay.
Yeah,
Are
absolutely.
we good with time? Are we?
Yeah, I think we're good.
So before my first book tour in 2017, my wife did a really sweet thing in that she invited some very smart friends over to our house, and she bought pizza and beer, and so we fed them and allowed them to imbibe in the spirits, and then we gave subjected them to a reading of my work. And after, so I read three chapters from my new book that I was about to give a lot of readings of on tour, and we had them write anonymous notes on each reading, and they were pretty honest because they had been drinking, and they're smart. So at the end, they handed in all their notes, and we said goodbye. And then my wife did it again a second time, got more notes, so it was really good. And one of the notes from my friend Fabrice, who's French American, a French professor at Regis University, or was at the time, now he's in New York. Fabrice said, you know, when you read, like everybody told me I was reading too fast and all that stuff. So I learned to slow down when I read. But Fabrice said, I knew it was Fabrice because I detected the French accent in his writing. But anyway, Fabrice said, you should read, he said, you read as if you don't love your own words. And he said, I've seen you, I've heard you read Dickinson, William Butler Yeats, et cetera, and you cry, like you love their words so much when you read. He said, you should love your own words when you read. And that was the best tip I've ever gotten from anybody about reading, because now when I read from my books, before I read, I just have a little quiet moment and I think, all right, you worked hard on these words. Let's love them. Let's give them a little love. And then I read, I hope, with love. And it's a better reading as a result. And we've all seen, Paul, we've all seen people read, you know, in a very boring manner, as if they're afraid of their own words. That was me. That's where I got that tip from.
Yeah, like they I've yes, I've seen people read where it's just monotone,
Oh
dry.
gosh,
Yeah.
yeah.
Yes, and
Why should I be interested in buying this book or reading your book if you're not?
yeah, it's great. Yeah, that's wonder it's that's wonderful advice. And I'm going to share that article on our website,
Cool.
wordafterwordpodcast.com.
Nice.
So what we're going to talk about here today, David, is your second novel was released last year. It's called The Gospel According to Danny, and it is a lighthearted fun romp, a look at American life.
The beach read.
But no, it's a very, how should I say it? It's a very slice of life. It's very real, is what I should say. You have a knack for creating characters and situations that are authentic. And forget it, I'm not going to go into just a little spoiler for a future episode. I'm going to do a deep dive into the Gospel According to Danny just on my own as a bonus episode to give my own review
Oh.
of it. So I'm not going to go too deep into it right now. That's for a future episode. But for right now, I'm going to let you describe the novel for us. How do you feel about Danny? Tell us about Danny.
I love Danny very much. Danny is a little bit of me and a little bit of my son and a little bit of other young men I've known or been. Danny Gospel, at the beginning, is on the upswing. He's 30. He's married, or he's getting married to his college sweetheart. He's got a new job as a head waiter at the American Bistro near the Bronx. They just bought their first home, but that all, like all that, all those trappings of the American dream turn out to be kind of a house of cards, kind of unstable because various infidelities, betrayals, a devastating school shooting, all kind of unravel his world, and everybody in it. And meanwhile, this is set from 2000 to 2015, as you know. The nation itself is unraveling. The Columbine Massacre, the contested Bush Gore election, 9/11, Black Lives Matter, the invention of the iPhone. So much is happening that divides a Tea Party. Remember the Tea Party, which kind of led to MAGA?
Yes, I
Over
remember.
that
Oh, I
time,
remember. Yeah.
over that time, Danny is forced to navigate personal and national upheaval while struggling to hold on to this dream, to this identity of himself as a hardworking husband and father. But that when that identity is just ripped away in a way that we're not going to talk about because I don't want to spoil anything, we don't know if he can reinvent himself in a country that also may need to reinvent itself because it no longer feels like home. Danny is a moderate Republican who suddenly feels like his party has abandoned him, and we really don't know what's going to happen. At the end of the book, Trump is nominated for the first presidency. It's 2015, and at that point, we really don't know what's going to happen next. But we do know Danny's fate in this kind of new world.
Yeah, and it's that's the thing about not to delve too deep into it, but I feel a lot of this resonated with me. I mean, and I think a lot of people went through this exact same situation, at least the exact same feelings as these events unfolded in our country.
Yeah, I remember, I distinctly remember, as I'm sure you do, November, the election of 2000, thinking, wow, this is going to really mess us up. Like, this either way, like it got really contentious. And it was, a lot of people were saying, like, oh, they're both compassionate conservatives. I'm like, one guy really wants to help the rich and, is going to give tax cuts and that kind of stuff. We didn't know about nine, we didn't know he was going to get us into a war in Iraq on trumped up charges. But and the other guy wants to save the world. Like he wrote a book about it.
Exactly.
That's is very concerned with climate change and wants to put America's resources towards, saving the globe. This very clear choice. And then it just got really ugly. Do you remember? It just dragged out over weeks and
Oh,
weeks.
I do remember. I remember going into work, and I had a fellow I worked with. Every day would come in and go, "We don't have a president." Yeah, and I remember having a conversation with a friend of mine at that time and saying, "Well, this is it. I mean, it doesn't get worse than this. We have hit rock bottom." And
And then
I
we
remember,
did.
yeah, and
It was.
I remember my friend just going, "Don't say that. We can always get lower." And lo and behold, he was
It
correct.
did. It really did.
Yes.
Yeah, I don't even know if this is rock bottom, but it's certainly bottomer than that was.
It's a
But
bottomer. You're a
it also
professor.
I think it's bottomer.
Yes.
It's bottomest, maybe. But I don't think I know there were contentious elections. And by the way, I know the nation was divided, like during slavery and Reconstruction, and even like now, like you can't tell anyone who's not straight white that the country was only started dividing in 2000. Like
Oh,
it
yeah.
just got worse politically to the point where, the political parties seemed to abandon us, both of them. And the school shooting, if you remember the school, Columbine was such a shocking thing. And then, since then, oh my God, it's like one a week, one a day at one point. Like it was, it's just been awful, but it's been normal now. At
Yes.
some point in the book, right in the beginning, Danny says something like, "I don't. We can't even call this a massacre anymore. Soon, it's just going to be Good Morning America." Like there's just every day. So if you think of in those terms, it sort of split us in two, and it's now we're just so mad at each other, especially online, that we can't even compromise at all that's represented in Congress. But the challenge, Paul, was to write a book, to write a story about a guy and not force feed the reader on any kind of political agenda, right? Because no, nobody wants to read that in a novel. So the challenge really was to contextualize, put Danny's life in that context, but don't make that context be the book, and don't let it take over the narrative. So at every turn during revision, I just kind of made it more and more about Danny as a kind of everyday, like every man, American every man, working hard, but neglecting the important stuff, because he's working so hard. So I got to the point finally after many, many revisions where it is about Danny. And it's also about the nation, but that's kind of reflected as opposed to making it about that.
And that's what makes it more powerful, I believe, is that because you can sit there and you can write an essay and you can preach and you're basically preaching to the crowd. That's what social media is. But when you contextualize it and you put it into the framework of a story and about a person, it because you see The message becomes much, much more clear and much more powerful. And that's what you achieved in this. It is a truly, I know David's my very dear friend. That aside, this is an incredible novel. It's so well written, and and I'm going to use that word again. It's very powerful. It's an incredible piece of work.
You're very sweet, Paul. Thank you. I want to mention another writer because what I was just talking about, because I want to take the attention away from you right now. But two days ago, I saw Nana Kwame Adjei-Brenya, who wrote the novel Chain Gang All Stars, and also a wonderful book of stories called Friday Black. And I think you might have another one. But in the reading, so Chain Gang All Stars is very much an expose. Well, it's also kind of futuristic and sci-fi, but it's an expose of the industrial prison system. And the opening scene is kind of a big fight in the middle of a prison yard, and everybody's shouting, and somebody's almost certain to die or be killed, kill another person. What Nana did when he read it was he first just read an essay about his growing up with his father. His father was a defense lawyer, and sort of understanding the prison system and the concept of guilt, or is a person guilty of murder? Well, then he deserves to go to prison. And his father would say, it's complicated, it depends. And then, having experience right now, he read an essay about helping out outside a detention center near his home, and seeing families coming to see their detained loved ones, an ICE detention center, and not being able to, being turned away because they're wearing the wrong shirt or some completely bullshit excuse. And so he's writing these essays that are very powerful, kind of agenda-driven essays, trying to raise awareness and rouse everyone to action. And then he's also reading from his novel, which is just an illustration of the problems that he's writing about, only very dramatic. So he solved the problem by writing a novel about one thing, but also writing essays about, the kind of political agenda. That's kind of one answer to this that I didn't really get to, which is split them in two and, preach about one and then depict or describe the story of a person. You know what I mean?
Yeah, that's fascinating.
And it's contextualized the way mine is, but it's much more subtle. And I think I arrived at some subtlety, but that is an issue for books that are written with a kind of political background. It's different kind of with any kind of political context or social context. But I think that's the same issue that Nana was wrestling with is what I wrestled with, and he pulled it off really well.
Well, that's I haven't read that, but
That's a recommended read. We're already at the section of our podcast where I recommend a book.
don't get ahead of ourselves here. We're still working on you. So this is your second novel. How did writing the first novel inform how you wrote this one? Did you approach writing differently because of the experience of writing a first novel?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. So the first novel is really a story collection. As if anyone's read it, they know it's true that I published a bunch of stories and that are autobiographical generally. And then I kind of put them, I at some point after a bunch got published, I thought, well, if I put these together chronologically, I thought I had a story collection, right? Because I had some published short stories. But if I put these stories together in order of the main character's maturity, development, then I had a kind of coming of age novel, or more than that, I had a novel about a guy who starts off one way and ends a different way. And that's what novels are, right? That's what stories are. Just a
Exactly.
character starts one way and ends another way because of the events in between. So I kind of pieced that together, but then I realized in order to publish this as a novel, I really need to make it a novel. In other words, it shouldn't feel like short stories all with their own resolution, all with their own story arc, each with its own story arc. In fact, it had to have a larger story arc too. So I had to rewrite some chapters and fill in some blanks with different points of view or different characters in order to make it a novel. This story, Gospel According to Danny, from the very beginning, I had one linear idea in mind that the character starts off this way and ends this way. And I had 2000 to 2015 in mind. because I started writing it in 2015. I started writing it when Trump was nominated. I thought, okay, because he himself, if you remember back then during the Republican primaries, there were many, like Jeb Bush and a whole bunch of other Republican candidates, including Marco Rubio and people who are now sycophants or friends of his or in the cabinet. He just made fun of them. Like he was disgusting. He was despicable. And then with Hillary, of course, we all remember that, calling her a nasty woman and all that. So
Well, that
it
was
was it was it.
but her emails.
Yeah, I know. So the degrading of American culture had come, I thought, to its like fruition. And okay, so now we all know what happened after that as I'm writing it. So okay, I want to go back to 2000 and write a book about a guy whose life kind of splinters as the country has. And I want to use my experience at being a waiter at a restaurant. I want to use kind of what I knew about having a difficult marriage, my first marriage. But also I wanted to use my new perspective about myself and where I went wrong in that marriage. I didn't want to play the blame game. In fact, this novel is interesting because I'm kind of more like the female character, the wife, than the husband. I'm kind of more like Leah than Danny in some ways. And people think Leah's the villain. I love her very much,
I
but
wouldn't
she
call
makes
her a villain.
some mistakes.
Yeah.
So that this novel is different in that it began in a with a clear kind of concept. It actually began with the ending, Paul, and the ending. I had this experience in Patagonia where I was standing on a cliff, and I was unloved and in a bad relationship, or not a bad relationship, just one where I wasn't feeling like there was a future in it. I was missing my children, and I would find myself at the bottom of the world, plus one, like a freebie, like a guy who just came along with a
Tag
journalist.
along, yeah.
Tag along, that's the word. I found myself as at the end of a world, at the bottom of the world with as a tag along, and very sad. And I was leaning out against this vicious winds that are Patagonia has like 70 mile per hour winds all the time because the oceans are coming together. And I just thought, if the wind stopped, because I was leaning out against the wind, if the wind just stopped, I would plummet to my death. And then it did. And I almost fell, and the wind sort of pushed me back. And I thought, okay, that's either the end of a story or the beginning of a story, and I'm not sure which one. So I decided it would be the end of the story, and the character would die. That felt very dramatic. But then when I wrote it and got to the end after like 500 pages, a friend of mine read it and said, "Hey, this is a really good book. Just that ending is horrible. It's like a Monty Python ending. Like, are you kidding me?" So the ending that the only part of this book I knew, which was the ending, was the part I deleted way before it got published.
Well, that brings up that's a fantastic story, by the way. But that brings up the idea of being loose and letting your writing evolve as the story. Let the story tell you what's going to happen.
Or let your friend tell you that it sucks.
Well, no, that's not true.
Hearing it
Okay.
back to you from someone is really important.
No, but what I'm trying to say is, like, people have this idea in their mind that it has to be rigid. I have it all outlined. This is exactly how the story goes. But I mean, at least from my experience, as I write something, I start to say, well, that guy's not, he would never say that. So then, and it starts to change and evolve. And as these things do, suddenly the story unfolds in a different way that you weren't expecting.
Yeah, and then there's surprise in the writing, so there's surprise in the reading. That's the key.
Yeah.
And as you said in the beginning, Paul, everyone writes differently. Like listening to Amor Towles, I thought, oh, I need to outline more, but and I really just need to do what I do. But if I adopt a little bit of that, so that, then there might be some writers who will outline. One writer told me it's like going on a road trip and knowing your destinations, but not knowing how you're going to get there. Like just kind of,
Yeah.
Taking a side trip to south of the border or wall or
Yeah.
someplace, the world's largest prairie dog or something like that,
Yeah.
unexpectedly, right?
Right. The
And
journey's the destination.
yeah, so and others are very strict, and it depends on what genre you're writing too, right? If you're writing murder mystery or romance, you need to have those tropes, you need to have that outline rigid, and you need to hit your marks. But if you're writing literary fiction, yeah, you don't really need to. You need to surprise yourself because we've all read books that seem strictly outlined, and it's just, or manuscripts because they don't make it to public in the published form, that are sort of aiming at the next scene in the outline instead of allowing the characters to evolve in each scene.
Exactly. I've read some story. Well, J.R.R. Tolkien has a he chronicled his writing process for many, many years. And it's I find it incredible to see how he wrote a story and he has something in mind, and then he suddenly introduces a new character and he says, well, that just changes everything. And he goes back. He called it beaches or waves on a beach. Because he would go like the wave would come in and then it would recede and he'd start over again and then write more. It would get a little bit further. Then he'd go back.
Oh, I love that.
So because he just, the story kept telling him, well, now you have to add this. Oh, and it kept getting bigger and bigger and bigger. Because Lord of the Rings was only supposed to be a quick sequel to The Hobbit. And then 16 years later, this massive volume.
You know what he does that that I'm really taking seriously these days? Because you hear people say, writers say, you got to pare the story down to its essentials and get rid of the side plots and side characters. But what Tolkien does, and for that matter, Amor Towles does this too in his novels, is he'll introduce another character and then he'll take his time. Like he'll give that character some airtime. Like you got to pay everybody in a movie if they talk. Like so sometimes you're just an extra and you don't talk, so you don't have to get paid. Tolkien pays everybody. Like everybody gets full sway, or at least a personality or characterization that's different from the main characters, right? And
Exactly.
it fills up and changes the novel a bit, but it also lengthens it so that so it got longer.
Well, in a similar genre, George R. R. Martin is having that issue right now, where
Apparently.
he keeps adding a new character. He's like, oh, that one needs a point of view now. Okay, so suddenly you have these massive novels and years to write it. Okay, so let's get back to you. do you have a routine that you follow for writing?
Oh, I'm gonna really disappoint you and everybody. I don't, and I want to. I'm like every other writer. Like I really want to have a routine. My God, I'm telling other people to have a routine. And I keep waiting for this routine, and I keep setting my alarm, and I have a schedule. Just I write when I can, and I write like frenetically and desperately, but I write a lot. I just write like in waiting rooms at airports and like in the afternoon after I teach, or especially when I meet a writing buddy to write. That's been the only consistent way for me to write is to have an appointment with a writing buddy every week or a certain day every week and show up for that person because I don't want to let them down. And then, write as long as I can while they're with me in a coffee shop or online on screen writing. It can't be by text and it can't be without a visual because I'll cheat. I'll check my email or do something else. But if the person is there with me and the person is or the person is on video, silence, muted, I will get my writing done. So I've come to, instead of insisting that someday I grow up and get a writing routine where that comes first before my job, before family, before everything in the morning, let's say 6 in the morning. Like some people wake up at 5 o'clock so they can get their writing done. I tried that, doesn't work. I just go back to sleep. Unless I have accountability and meeting someone, that stuff doesn't work. But instead of just waiting for myself to grow up and get a writing routine, I've now just decided that, well, the one thing that works is when I meet with a writing buddy. So let me just schedule a bunch of writing buddies. So then, like for every day of the week, if I can. And then when one sort of goes away or gets too, can't make it anymore, I still have others on other days of the week. Or if I have like a Friday morning buddy and it goes away for several Fridays in a row, it's so much a part of my habit that I just wake up on Friday and write, so because it's in my bloodstream by that point. But I don't have I I've heard writers say they write 1,000 words a day and they stop in the middle of the sentence, or I've heard them say I write from 6 to 7:30 no matter what, my morning coffee. And I do know writers who do that, but all they're doing is journaling, and there's nothing wrong with journaling, but they don't ever get to their manuscript and work on that. So it's all good, but I'm so old and desperate that I want to just get right back to my book, my work in progress. I don't have time for journaling. I need to revise this damn thing. And I get excited about it, and I get, really turned on by going back to my manuscript. But I also feel a strong sense of obligation to do my job well and to, read my students' work and to, answer those emails. Because I'm the director of a program. We have 90 students and we have 25 faculty members. I'm responsible for a lot of things. So there are a lot of pulls away from writing. And I know people listening have their own pulls. It could be family obligations, it could be work, it could be whatever. And we all kind of distract ourselves from away from writing. But I alone have found that having writing buddies meeting me online or in person is the answer.
Well, that works. If that works, it's funny when you talked about how you don't want to disappoint the other, but you'll disappoint yourself. Because I do that all the time.
Oh, it's time to
I'm
talk about
letting myself down
our
all the
Catholic
time.
upbringing.
Exactly. I remember this made me actually feel better about myself. I read an essay by Douglas Adams about his writing process. And what he said was he would get up every morning and he had his little Apple computer. And he had pens and paper with all his notes, and he had his reference materials, and he'd had everything laid out geometrically on his desk. And then he would look out the window and say, "I want to be out there." And he would leave. He said, and he'd do that every single day until the deadline approached. And then he's like, "Oh, I got to crank this shit out." Right as fast as he can. It's like, it's not, it's not exemplary, but at least because that's, I write like that a lot, which is just horrible. I want to be the
Squirrel.
guy who sits down every day at a certain time and, writes a set amount of words.
I know.
But I don't
We
do
all
that.
do. I know. I kick ass on an airplane. Like I in any place where or bus terminal or any kind of place where I have no, I can't possibly get distracted, or if there's no Wi-Fi. So like the greatest present my wife gave to me, she's given it to me several times now, she just gave it to me for Christmas, is like either an Airbnb gift certificate or like a reservation at a cabin in the woods or something for like 2 nights. I will go early and I will start writing even before, like during in the car, I'm writing, right? In the car I'm composing, or 2 days before I start writing so I can get it. And then I write all day and then I write up till midnight or whatever. And then I wake up early and keep writing and I write obsessively. That's why like artist residencies are the greatest thing if you can get one. Because there are no distract, everyone there is working on their art. So you'd be an idiot if you like went to the gym downtown or something. Like you just have to take full advantage of that time. I'm just like you, and just like who was it that you said does that?
Douglas Adams.
Douglas, oh my gosh, Douglas Adams. And he gets a lot done.
Well, he did.
Speaking of obsessive, right? Or well, no, the opposite of Adams is I think it was Cheever who used to wake up in his New York City apartment, I think it was New York, and he would get he dressed up in a suit. I mean, this is back in the day where men wore suits all the time. And he would get his briefcase, writing materials, and typewriter, and then go downstairs to the janitor's office, I think it was, the basement. He'd take the elevator down to the basement, set up at the janitor's desk, or I think the janitor let him, or the supervisor, soup, let him use his office. And they did write all morning. And I think he would start drinking in the afternoon or something, but he stayed there all day like it was a job and then came home. And, so for starters, it's hard to get to that point where you could afford to do that, where that's all you're doing all day. But to treat writing like a job is the goal, right? Your primary job. And then there's the job you have where you make money and pay the bills. But to treat your writing as the priority, like first thing in the morning, and if you go to bed thinking of your book, like writing 5 minutes a day is okay because at least you're writing at the beginning or end of the day and you're keeping it current instead of that awful feeling you and I both know of like having to say, okay, I've got time to write. And then you have to reread everything you've written because you got to get caught up on yourself. And then you start revising that old stuff and then you never get to anything new. Whereas if you're writing a little bit every day, especially at night and the morning, you sort of go to bed with your book and you wake up with your book, and there's no need to sort of catch up. You just enter right into it. And sometimes you have really nice on the brink of unconscious thoughts while you're falling asleep or while you're waking up that usually lead to some very good scenes or very good writing.
I really would love to have a routine like that. And it, you got me thinking because, okay, so my, so the listeners know my real job, how I make money is I do web design and tech support. And I work from home. I've been working from home pretty much since 2000. That's I've been lucky enough to be able to do that. Mm-hmm. But working from home is a different beast because you could just slide out of bed in your pajamas and slop in front of the computer.
Right.
But in order for me to be productive, I adopted a routine where I do exactly what you were saying. I get up, I take a shower, I get dressed as if I'm going out. And when I go to work, I'm going to work. And then when I'm done, I shut the computer down and I leave work. So, because otherwise you could just fall into a very sloppy set of habits.
Do you have like an off, are you talking about going to an office in your apartment or house, or are you talking about going to like a coffee shop or somewhere?
Oh no, I have a little room set aside with my, you know, where I am right now.
So you get dressed and you go to work.
I'd get dressed and I go to work.
Yeah.
And I do my job and it helps me. It gets me into the mindset of like, I'm working now. I'm doing my job. And now if I were to adopt that for my writing life, you've got me thinking, sir, because I already do it for one aspect of my life.
Right.
Maybe I can do it for another.
And it might have to be a different room or a different place, right? I made the mistake of doing my, because I run an online, mostly online, it's a low residency program. So I can work from home anytime. And I made the mistake of being in my office, whether I'm working at the university or I'm working on my own writing. And it doesn't work.
No.
I mean, it works, but it doesn't, right? But whereas if I go to a coffee shop or if I go somewhere else just for writing, like if I'm at my office at school, if I want to write or meet someone at lunchtime to write, I go to the nearby coffee shop, or I used to go into a different room in the same building that was quiet. Now it's a different kind of room, so I can't go there. But I had to go somewhere else. And that, I think, is true of many writers that I've talked to, where you need your own writing space. It doesn't work to say, well, you know, just at 7 o'clock, I'll just do my writing in the same place where I'm doing my work. No. And a lot of more people are having this difficulty now because a lot more people are working from home or working in a hybrid job. So, and you know, there's only so many rooms in an apartment or house. Like you can't just take over two bedrooms for your two offices. So a lot of times we have a friend, Rich Cadwalader, who I think he had a pub near his house. And I have a friend in Virginia who will go to a pub and just like nurse a beer. Like he's not getting drunk. He's just in a place with white noise and everybody's leaving him alone as long as he's got his beer in front of him. Coffee shop, same thing. There's other people doing, you know, working on their laptops, but none, they're not going to talk to you. Like, just don't talk to me. Leave me alone. I got my latte or I got my beer and I'm going to get my work done.
Yeah. Library is the same way for me.
Oh,
I can go to a library, find a little, just a little desk somewhere. So many libraries these days are now set up to be places to write and to get work.
Yes. And nobody, everybody's going to leave you alone.
Yep.
And you just do whatever you want for as long as you want and make sure you hydrate and get some writing done. Yeah. And so
always
that
hydrate.
Can become, yes. If that could become part of your routine where you're just a regular every Friday at 1 o'clock or whatever, then it's kind of sweet because then it's a place where people say, oh, hey, nice to see you again or whatever. And then, you know, they leave you alone.
So exactly.
And everybody gets used to it. If you're in a relationship or you're living with someone or a lot of people, if you have a family, they all get used to it. They know that on this day at this time, you're going to be going to your library desk and hope to get the one in the back room. Hope you get that empty desk. And that's where you're going to be for 2 hours.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, I'm lucky. We just made a plan.
I think we just created a routine. Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, this is fantastic. Look at it. This is, if nothing else, this is a therapy program for ourselves. So let's wrap this segment up just by saying everyone needs to find their own individual, like what works for you. There isn't a right or wrong way to do this as long as you get it done. And obviously, David, you found a way to get it done because The Gospel According to Danny is a stellar novel. It's absolutely a stunning piece of work, and everyone should read it. I'm gonna have links to purchase it, to purchase the novel, in the show notes. So please do
Thank you,
that.
Paul. Thank you.
So let's move on to our next segment, which is
Okay.
David's Corner. This is a new
Cue the theme
segment.
music.
I know, I was just thinking that I should have theme music. So, listeners, if you just heard music, I did a really good job editing. So this is our segment where David, you're going to give us our monthly writing tip. What do you
Okay.
have for
And
us this time?
Paul, I've decided that each month I'm going to focus on a writing tip and a book recommendation that is really current with me, not something I've necessarily talked about before, but it's been inspired by where I'm at with my own writing. Because I think then I'll speak more honestly and passionately about it because I'm learning myself. But the tip for this month is about voice. And I'll tell you about this, but first I want to tell you why I'm talking about this. I wrote my first novel almost 30 years ago, and it was good, but it wasn't good enough to get an agent. I was a finalist in a few contests. I like the story very much. It's about 3 days in Italy, based on my own experience, when my mom's from Italy and near Naples, and my Italian family, that area, experienced some strange earthquakes, and there was a family scandal, et cetera. So I'm sort of fictionalizing that. It never got anywhere, and I went on to write other stories and books. I just went back after The Gospel According to Danny. I just went back to that novel, and to see, like, it's been on my mind. It's a little bit about my sister's death, so I wanted to come back to it after writing that children's book about my sister's death. It kind of opened up like some questions for me about the novel, and I went back to it and I immediately saw the problem with the first version of that novel. Immediately, the first paragraph, I saw that the voice was wrong. The narrative voice was bland. It was just kind of not even there. It almost as if it's almost as if there was no voice. Like it was just a narrator letting the story sort of take over, the characters kind of take over the story without any kind of energy. And in between that first version of it and today, I've learned a lot about voice just by practicing, just by writing, injecting a little bit of an attitude, like in some stories, like written from the point of view of a Bronx kid who's hitchhiking across the country with that kind of Bronx attitude. Some others with there's a kind of nostalgic voice or a yearning voice or something. And this voice of this book, I knew immediately what it needed, and it kind of needed a memoir type, an intimacy, an older man's voice, because I'm older now. And I look back on that trip that I took when I was 17 with this kind of like almost like Cinema Paradiso kind of yearning, nostalgia, romance, but also wisdom, like, can't believe I did that, but let's talk about that. No, let's recount that. Not as a kind of diary dump, but as a kind of memoir and a memoir, but it's not a memoir, it's a novel. But it's I changed it to first person, so I changed the point of view from he to I. I also changed the frame, starting with now, on a trip to Italy I took just months ago, and then the bulk of the story shifting over to like 1980 and just kind of writing about what happened back then and then coming back to the present. But both those stories have to move.
I like that
So
framing.
and
I like that framing narrative.
oh, cool. Yeah, it's good as long as as long as that outer story doesn't exist just to hold the backstory, you know what I mean? Just like sitting there, it needs to move. Because after you go to the backstory, you need to think, okay, well, what is the present narrator learned from recounting this story or whatever? Or, how can we show that? So the and but what I mean by memoir voice is not a voice where it's like an honest re an honest recapturing of the events of my past. Oh no, it's more of like the slightly untrustworthy, dishonest narrator trying to remember what really happened, but also reluctant to tell you. You know, like that's the narrator of a memoir, a successful memoir, is usually someone who's trying to figure it out on the page rather than someone who has figured it out and is telling you about it.
Yeah,
That's
that's like,
boring.
look at this great thing I did.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And when there are very successful memoirs like that, I prefer the one where the writer says things like, I'm not sure what happened. Like my friend Charlotte Gulick wrote a memoir and she several times says, I don't know, but I've been told this.
Right.
Or, you know, I'm not sure this happened. And in my case, it's a lot of it is I can't distinguish memory from like a photograph, like I or an image somebody gave me or some a story somebody told me a long time ago. Did that happen? Or and I like am I remembering that happened? Or am I did I imaginatively construct that memory out of something someone told me?
Yeah, I love
That
that. Yeah.
is the voice of this book now, and it gives it a kind of uncertain energy that I really like.
That's brilliant. I love that kind of Rashomon
Yes.
aspect. Like
Yes.
everyone else, there's several different people having different perspectives on the same
Right.
event.
Right.
And then you have to question, like, well, did that really happen or
Yeah.
not? I love that.
So my tip is if you're working on something and it's not quite going great, or someone, you know, if you give it to a reader and they think it's okay but needs work, try changing the voice. Like if you change the voice, the whole story might change. Certainly if you change the point of view, the whole story sort of changes. Everything else gets better, dialogue, setting, everything. But try changing the voice to just a someone else telling the story. Could be the voice of a side character. It could be the voice of a friend or some omniscient narrator or some narrator who's invested in the story. It could be, you know, just a guy trying to figure it out, but it's not from your knowledgeable point of view. It's from someone who doesn't quite know the whole story's point of view. So in my case, I changed it to first person and a memoir kind of voice, but it could be something else next time to a more aggressive or more nostalgic voice. So I'm really talking about tone here. So I think the tip is try rewriting with a different voice and see if that makes it better.
That's great. That's brilliant. Just giving it a new perspective and new ideas crop up from that. That's
Yeah.
excellent. Yeah.
The original reason why we love stories is the voice, is the, you know, the librarian or somebody telling us a story in our ears. And it remains true that the voice is everything, that voice in our ear, but we often get sidetracked with other things.
Well, that's what story was. That's how it was sitting around the campfire or the village circle and having the elder tell us a story. And
The bard
that,
in the amphitheater.
yes, exactly. Love it. So thank you, David. That was David's Corner.
Theme
This is
song.
theme song. So, before we finish off, we're going to have every episode from here on in. We're going to finish off with doing a book recommendation. So,
Cool.
tell me, David, what you're reading?
Does this get a theme song too?
I don't know, maybe.
I think so.
But okay, here's the
Okay.
theme song, ladies and gentlemen. You're making me do extra work, David. Thank you very much. So tell me what you're reading.
I am reading Nana Kwame Adzogbenya's story collection that I mentioned earlier, called Friday Black. His novel Chain Gang All Stars is the bestseller. It's what sort of launched him into fame just a little last year or months ago. But I really love and I love that book. But I really am enjoying very much the short stories that he wrote. And I understand he's working on a new book of short stories. He's a very good short story writer, and they're wildly various. Some are kind of very there's stories that are sort of violent and sci-fi, and there's stories that are really tender and autobiographical. So I'm really enjoying it, and I highly recommend it. Friday Black.
Friday Black. Again, we'll put that in the show notes. My recommendation this month is, first of all, I want to point out David and I have different tastes in literature. I tend to read a lot of genre fiction and specifically sci-fi, fantasy, and horror.
You would really like, Paul, you would really like Chain Gang All-Stars, because it's kind of your jam.
Okay, cool. I will. Excellent. I'll pick that up. So anyway, that being said, my recommendation is "Eat the Ones You Love" by Sarah Maria Griffin.
What a great title.
Yes, and it is about a woman who starts works in a takes a job in a really small flower florist, and there is a sentient man-eating plant in the back. And yes, she does equate it to Little Shop of Horrors. In fact, this has been described as the queer version of Little Shop of Horrors. But it goes it it's a it, it gets it's a little bit more in depth than that. So this woman has this plant, and then there's another woman who owns the shop, and they get into a relationship, but the plant is jealous. It's incredible.
Nice.
It's really, really good. Sarah Maria Griffin, Irish author, and she writes in this, and this might sound as if I'm trying to be insulting. I'm not. She writes in a very cozy way. Like her voice is just, it's just very soft, and it's very almost nonchalant in the way she writes. But then you juxtapose that with murder and cannibalism, and it's incredible. And if you ever see an interview with her, she's just one of the sweetest people. I would love to have her on the show and talk about writing with her.
Well, let's invite her.
I'm going to.
Put her on the list.
Yeah, I'm putting the feelers out there. But anyway, Eat the Ones You Love. It's a really good book. And of course, as with all horror and genre fiction, it's not really about it has a lot to do with toxic relationships and how we navigate through and finding true love, but told with a man-eating plant.
Sweet.
Yes, it's wonderful. So again, I'll put that down in the show notes. All right. So I think that's it. I think we've gone a little long this particular time.
It's to be expected.
It's to be
I'm a
expected.
bit of a blowhard.
We
I'll
both
try to
like
keep.
we both love talking about ourselves. So
Yes.
yeah.
Oh, well, you actually didn't talk about yourself at all, but you'll get a chance next time.
Oh, I
I'll ask
will.
you some questions.
Absolutely. So everyone out there, if you're listening, we'd love to
You're
hear
still
from you.
listening.
If you're still listening, if you made it this far, congratulations. We'd love to hear from you. So send us your comments or questions, and we'd love to answer and have some correspondence on the show. So
Oh,
send us any
Paul.
comments or yes, David.
Future podcasts, we can do letters like Thursday Night Letters or something. Like here are the letters from the week or something. It needs a theme song, obviously, but
Obviously.
if we get some good, I'm sure we're going to get some good comments about writing strategies or writing practices. So then we can read them in a segment I'd like to call The Comments We Got.
Wow, that's brilliant. David is a professional writer.
Yep.
So if you have any questions or comments, please send them to us, and we'll read them in a very special segment that David just detailed. Yeah, and let us know if you have any reading recommendations. That would work as well. To do that, go to our website, wordafterwordpodcast.com. You can leave comments on individual episodes, or fill out our contact form, or just send an email to comments@wordafterwordpodcast.com. If you prefer to talk to us on social media, best thing to do is Blue Sky. That's pretty much the only place I go to as far as social media is concerned. And there we are, Word After Word Pod. So get in touch. Let's start a conversation. Let's grow this segment a little bit bigger. That's it for me. David, do you have anything else you want to conclude with?
Thanks for listening. Nice talking to you, Paul. See you next time.
And I think, yes, that'll do it. So till next time, just keep writing.
Word After Word, a podcast on writing, is a Daddy Elk production.